fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Alrighty, welcome back to another episode of Lookout Podcast, making sure we're recording here. I am with Heidi Breckenbush.
Yeah, essentially. Breckenbush.
Breckenbush. Mm-hmm. There we go. Jeez, you just told me I already messed it up. Who is a mule packer, a registered dietitian, and like we just covered a long list of stuff that you do. But are you still with the Forest Service? Or are you?
No, as of, let's see, end of the fiscal year, this last year. No longer with the Forest Service.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, feels odd. It's been a lot of seasonal work.
Yeah.
Nothing full time, but yeah.
Oh, gotcha. And you were packing for the Forest Service or?
Yeah. So I started in 2016 with the Forest Service doing some fire stuff. And we could get into that. But
absolutely.
Most recently did 3 seasons packing as an 18 and 8, out of the Fen Ranger Station.
On
the Selway.
Yeah, unless you know Kevin Roach, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
our boy.
One of our lookouts.
Yeah.
One of our few, yeah.
Yeah, 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 he's the man. I was pretty fortunate to talk to him. It's kind of cool because, like, the small circle of us that isn't so small, as I get more involved, like, with, you know, like, diet and activity and just outdoors, you know, it's, like, super cool.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one of your posts, and I meant to ask you about this before, but no, I'll ask you about it now, was, of course, like, the loudest trucks go by as soon as you start recording.
That's all right.
But yeah, sorry, folks. I probably won't pick it up too well because the mic's pretty good. But it was you on the back of a horse, and it was like kind of snowy out, and you're like 3 degrees to find out that what I want to do doesn't involve degrees at all or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
On your post.
Yep.
What are your degrees in?
So I went to University of Idaho kind of reluctantly because I grew up in central Idaho.
Oh, you did?
I thought I would go to Montana State because I wanted to go to an outdoorsy school out of state.
Yeah.
And then I looked at tuition and I thought, I think I'm going to be a vandal.
Having a lot of us, right?
Yeah. So I stuck in state, which is like, it's like an hour and a half from where I grew up, which was honestly kind of nice. I'm glad I did. But throughout high school, I did FFA and did a food science event.
Yeah.
And I've always really been into food and nutrition. From my work as a kid, I worked at a backcountry ranch and was really interested in cooking, gardening, all that. So, went into food science, studied that, which is kind of like food and its interaction in the environment, like everything from field to plate or package or, you know, bottle if it's brewing.
Oh, yeah.
All the different science and chemistry involved, which was awesome. I was very into that. But I finished my undergrad and decided I'm really interested in what happens when you put it in your mouth. Like, okay, now what?
Yeah.
So then kind of food's role in the human body. So then I got a master's degree in, I guess technically it's dietetics. And then I did a thesis project related to wildland fire nutrition education and got a second master's in family and consumer sciences. So I just kept going to school. Part of it is because I was still interested, always have loved to learn, but also because I think I loved my seasonal Forest Service work so much that I just couldn't picture not going back to that either. So they kind of went hand in hand. But
yeah. Totally. And then keep feeding your brain too in the off season. Cause that's what I noticed with my seasonal career, you know, starting in fire and, well, you know, up until I got a full-time job, you know, doing fire seasonally for like 17 years. And when I was in the off season, like I was getting kind of restless and I couldn't put my finger on it until like, you know, I got forced out of jumping because my Crohn's was getting so bad that I couldn't do it anymore. My health was, you know, starting to really suffer. So then, you know, tried structure fire. Didn't realize it was going to be way, way harder on me. And it was. It was like
really
way worse. Didn't last very long, unfortunately. But I thought that'd be a better balance because you have, you know, more, a little bit more time off. You know, those 24-hour shifts, though, are super brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And my family doc, I think I told the story before, but apologies for folks who've heard it. But being a small-town kid, you know, from Whitehall, my family doc, Dr. Reif, awesome guy, he, you know, they treat you like a second dad, right? Like, so, you know, you go in there, and instead of being like, oh, man, yeah, that's tough, you know, like, yeah, it's more like, well, what were you doing there? Like, how'd you hurt yourself? You know, like, mm-hmm. yeah, you got to think before you do something. Kind of like more the, you know, tough love stuff, which I really love, really appreciate. So I go in there and I'm not feeling good. And I'm talking to my doctor about it and like trying to get my medical resignation from the structure fire. And I think I needed some like prednisone too for my Crohn's because my inflammation was going bananas and my system's all messed up. But he like gave me this like really tough, like fatherly love kind of speech. And he's like, well, what are you doing with yourself? I was like, I don't know. He's like, you know, shift work is hard on healthy humans and you're not a healthy human. Like, what are you thinking? And I was like, guess it wasn't. He's like, that's what, yeah. He's like, you're damn right. You're, you know, or something like that. You weren't thinking. And he's like, are you trying to, you know, die before you hit 50? He's like, cause that's what's going to happen if you keep this up. Like if you keep fighting fire and doing all this other stuff, like you're going to have a very short life. You know, it was what I needed to hear, and like, at no point was I mad at him. I was like, oh, God, yeah, you're right. You know, like, but I didn't think it through before I went to structure fire. I was just like, well, I can control my diet, you know, and that's what I thought was like the big problem. And apparently, it was like all the above, you know, stress, lack of sleep, and diet. You know.
Yeah, yeah, it comes with some other elements, similar but different, obviously, from Wildland. But yeah, absolutely. It sounds like a good doctor too to tell you what you needed to hear too.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, I think we need more of that. You know, like I appreciate that. You know, if I could find, because he'll probably be retired by the time my kid is, or like, well, I don't live in Whitehall anymore, but I don't think he's got, you know, he might not even be still practicing anymore. I haven't been back home in a long time, but you know, if I could find that for my kids too, because you get that community sense, you know, when you have like a doctor that cares about you. I mean, he show up at every sporting event and like a whole community that, you know, takes a village to raise, you know, family kind of deal. And that's really how I felt in Whitehall. I was pretty lucky there. But, you know, getting back to what you were talking about with the education in the off season. I was forced to go back to school because I couldn't do anything else. And I was like, dang, this is kind of what I was missing. You know, like going back to school and also like actually putting some effort into it. Like I never really did when I was a kid. And so like I had some really challenging classes that would have ate my lunch before. But, you know, like getting the mindset of like everything's hard work. And if you put that kind of like focus on, no matter what it is, like digging line, you know, hiking, working out, or even, you know, just in like bookwork, you know, like studying and schoolwork, man, you get the same results if you give that same effort. And then so I went into that mindset to get my prereqs for physical therapy, and man, I did pretty good because the highest math I'd ever taken was algebra, like general algebra. And yeah, then I had to take physics, calc-based physics 1 and 2, which is, you know, way above my level, but I was able to figure it out because I just put in a ton of time.
Yeah,
you know?
You had that work ethic too.
Yeah, the work ethic. In. Yeah, totally.
That's cool.
Yeah, you kind of, you know, you change your focus. You know, when I first went to school, I was just young and restless and focused more on sports and just doing school because I had to, you know?
Yeah.
And then I went back, I was like on a mission, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, yeah, that's funny that you brought up that post. I do love what I do in the nutrition realm, and I'm glad I went to school so much, but
yeah,
it is kind of funny because I don't technically need a degree for some of the other work that I like to do. So,
but what you're doing now, you kind of are falling back on your education a little
doing
bit now,
both, or? Yeah. So I was in like a term Forest Service position, and the funding is kind of dried up. Things are changing, yeah, obviously. So there's still a packer, luckily, on our forest, but the secondary position is not there that I was in for an 18 and 8. So, but it's kind of a natural time for me to move away from that. I didn't plan on ever being a career packer. I really admire people that are, but
yeah,
I wanted the experience and I wanted to work a physical job for a while, but I didn't want to do that until I was, you know, 55, 60.
Yeah, don't blame you.
So that's also part of why having a couple degrees are nice to fall back on and maybe have a family and settle down a little bit more. We have a lot of our own stock too. So now I can use my own critters and go to the places that I decide, not just on the forest, but you know, you name it. Never been to the Bob Marshall, and that's like Packers paradise, so gotta get there. That's on my list,
definitely. Yeah.
But yeah, so I'm still doing some nutrition related things, which I learned I can work half as much and make the same amount. So in theory I have half as much time to goof off, but
yeah.
So I'm working at the hospital as a clinical dietitian part-time. Oh, nice. And I started doing that this last field season too. So that was real hectic. But
oh, I bet.
Started to work at the hospital. And then I also work now at a physical therapy clinic.
Oh, hey.
So that's a lot of weight loss, but some other different conditions that we manage too as well in the outpatient setting, where you have a lot more time to work with folks and meet with them one-on-one.
Oh, huge. Yeah, especially that outpatient stuff.
Yeah. So that's been really cool. Also, what else? Oh, yeah, doing some, like, contract work.
Oh, very cool.
For different agencies, doing wildland stuff and meeting with crews. I'm really passionate about wildland firefighters still. They're still my buddies, and I know a lot of them. So, yeah, I don't know. I have a lot going on. I haven't reached the critical limit quite yet, but...
Oh, that's cool. Well, and you want to, right? Like, that's where you want to be bumping the critical limit, I think, to get for the most out of this life.
Yeah, and I've always kind of been the type that I think needs that a little bit, and it's all stuff, like, when you're passionate about what you're doing, it doesn't feel like you're running on E all the time, so I love it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, you can run on, like, a little less sleep and stuff if you're, you know what you're doing the next day is going to be something you really want to do, you know, or pushing you forward towards whatever goal, you know? Like, I know I have that with this, too. It's like, I can get up extra early and go interview somebody if need be, or, you know, going through, like, some pretty nasty weather with this, trailer a few times. Like, I think it was one time I got up, I think it was, like, negative 10, and it warmed up a little bit by the time the interview came around, but I came to town at, like, 7, and it was, like, 2 below, and I had, like, a couple of space heaters in here, you know, trying to keep it warm, and there's, like, frost coming on the inside of the window, you know, but like you said, when you're doing, you know, what you're passionate about, like, it's not a big deal, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing what you'll endure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. In, like, seasonal extremes, too, packing.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Found that. Yeah. Like, if I go ski on a cold day, sometimes I'm an absolute weenie about it.
Yeah.
But if I'm out with stock and, like, have something to do that's productive, it's amazing what you can endure.
Yeah, totally. And you got, like, that companionship, I think, too. Mm-hmm. You're like, you know, if it's, you know, like, a horse that you've been with a while, or even, like, the mules, you know, you get a connection there. And
yeah,
it's not so bad. It's like, oh, we're doing it, buddy. You know, that's what I'm always like, at least, like, you know, packing into a hunting camp or something with my dad's horses. And yeah, I just have a little bit of bond, even if I'm freezing, you know?
Totally, yeah.
And then, you know, put my hands under the mane a little bit, you know, sometimes or in the saddle.
Yep,
you know?
That's a good spot. Good little hand warmer.
Yeah.
Good little hand warmer pocket.
My dad always had, like, a duster and all the, you know, all the old, older boys around Whitehall. Old horse guys, I guess what I'm trying to say. Old's kind of a rough word, but, you know, older than me. They had, like, some big dusters and stuff, you know, and I think that helps because then you get a little heat coming in from the duster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and it slicks away the moisture is a huge thing.
Oh, yeah.
One thing I do a lot, which I'm young and feel like doing it, I know a lot of the more seasoned packers, like the guy that I replaced used to never walk. I walk so much. If I get cold, I get off and walk. If it's steep downhill, I get off and walk. So I'm doing a lot more walking than people probably realize. I don't just ride the horse and go everywhere. I walk if I'm cold, for sure.
Yeah, smart. That's a good call. And yeah, it kind of keeps you know, awake and going. Because, like, for me, at least, if I'm in the saddle and it's, like, a long, you know, like, walk, I just get in the rhythm and I'm, like, kind of dozing. You know, one eye open, like, oh, God.
1,000%, yeah. Usually about the time I fall asleep, a rattlesnake gets underneath the string or something exciting happens. Yeah. But
yeah. Oh, something to bring the energy back.
Yeah, they can be some long days. God. What did you do growing up then? Your dad had critters and you went to hunting camp? Is he still?
Yeah, he still has a bunch of horses. My little brother's a veterinarian. And yeah, originally, like, me and my wife are going to adopt, I don't even know how many he has left, like 5? But he had, like, somewhere close to 10 there for a minute, 10 horses. And he lives in pretty rocky country, and he thought about getting, like, a couple steers to just raise and, you know, like, sell half to the neighbor and keep half kind of deal, you know, and try to, like, make it so it's, like, sustainable where he's not having to pay a bunch for hay. And he's got enough pasture. He's got 160 acres so that he could leave it out to, you know, roam around a little bit and not have to pay too much in hay for, like, in the cold, you know, if it snows or whatever. And basically just horses and helping out some of my buddies, you know, ranching growing up because, you know, big ag country around Whitehall, just like you said, in Bozeman too. So a lot of friends that were, you know, had some fields and some irrigation that I got to help out on. And like you said, mostly just hunting camp and then just going on some, like, fun rides with the family.
Cool.
Yeah, my experience on a horse and which is nice because growing up in a small little country town, you kind of figure everybody knows how to saddle a horse and knows their way around stock. But then you get out and away from that, community, and you're like, oh, not so many people really know, are that comfortable around horses, I guess. Mm-hmm. Even the Forest Service, which I was kind of surprised.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I know 9 Mile puts on horsemanship 101, and they'll send folks to the class just because there's like trail crews and stuff that are told take your own horse and maybe a mule and, you can supply your crew, but a lot of them haven't spent any time around critters. But
yeah,
it's cool that they offer that. And I think it's so cool that some of the areas, especially up here, like in the Bob Marshall and some of those areas, they still do that quite a bit and folks are using stock pretty heavily. So that's cool.
Totally. Like you said, the class is good too. Cause I had to take the class, have the certificate, do anything in the Forest Service. And, everything was pretty, basic stuff for me, but there were some good tips for folks who weren't familiar. And especially I think most people realize from all the movies that getting behind a horse could be pretty dangerous, but then it makes you scared to even be anywhere near him. Most people, put your arm on the back of the horse and walk around. So the horse knows you're there. And then you're keeping him close enough to where he shouldn't, have any damage to you if he tries to kick you. But, I think it makes people gun shy being anywhere behind a horse, probably for the better, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. I mean, it's good to be, cautious.
Yeah, cautious. Yeah, for sure. That's kind of what I was searching for.
But they are giant. I mean, I get why people are scared. People always give me a hard time. I grew up around horses, similar to you. Like, my dad would always go to hunting camp and spend a lot of time in the subway. That's kind of why I had draw to it when I was working. Yeah. But, he would always spend time with stock in the backcountry and... I grew up around horses. He's always had them. So I wasn't really scared of them. They were just part of life and they were big, but you learned how to be around them. But I'm really scared of bugs. Anything small that could be hiding under this couch cushion.
Oh, really?
No, thanks. But people give me a hard time because they're like, you're not afraid of a 1,000-pound critter, but a tick freaks you out. I'm like, you don't know where they're going to be.
Oh my God. Yeah. Ticks rough because, I don't really fear them, but I do not like them because you get that weird itch and you're like, what is that? And all of a sudden you peel down your shirt and you're like, oh damn it. Ticks in your shoulder,
Some of my fire buddies on the subway are saying that they're already finding ticks, which I heard that. Crazy.
Yeah. It's nuts. Yeah. Cause they were telling us around Hamilton on the Bitterroot that they've been out a little bit. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
This time of year. The other day I was hiking. I can't remember where the heck I was going, but, somewhere for work that's all I was thinking about. I was trying to look at the leaves. Cause you ever seen that little tiny, somehow they got footage of one on a petal of grass or a leaf or something. And it's on its back and it's got his little arms and he's just waiting for something to walk by to attach itself to. So I'm looking, trying to act like I can see that. There's no way.
I know. That's why I don't like him. If that were a horse, you'd know it was there.
Exactly. Yeah, true. Or a weird stick. I had a one-eyed horse that hated anything that was snake-like. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know he hated snakes. Anything that looked even... Sometimes there were some things where I'm like, dude, I'd get off and I'd be so mad because, he about launched me because he'd do that crow hop to the side or something, and I'm like, ha! and I about get launched off and I get out, I get off his back. It's huge. What's an average size horse? 15 hands, 16 hands?
Probably, yeah. I mean, gosh. There's so much variation. They come in every size and shape.
And then my brain, you forget once when you're not really around him. And I can't remember, he's 18. He was huge. He was part heavy horse. Some kind of draft was in him, His legs were just massive. Super cool looking, kind of dinosaur looking horse. Loved him. But he only had one eye, so you kind of watch that. But man, I mean, this one stick was on his left side, and that was his blind side. Somehow he thought I was a snake, and maybe because he was kind of blurry in his one good eye. And it about launched me, and I was so mad I got up and grabbed that stick.
You're like, it's fine. Everything's fine.
Yeah, totally. He's like, oh, man. And then I about launched myself one time because wasn't thinking. I had a puffy jacket rolled up, behind the saddle, kind of behind my butt. Mm-hmm. And wind started, a little squall kind of come up in the, hunting season time, and that's when it was. We might have actually been going in, packing in for hunting season. But I'm in a light sweatshirt like this, and all of a sudden, sun goes away, blowing snow just like that, and oh man, so I just go to rip that jacket off, not thinking, being young and dumb, and it kind of flashes by his head, all of a sudden I'm going circles like crazy, and my dad's buddy's just like, drop the coat, and it took three of them, and all of a sudden I was like, oh, and I grabbed the horn again, and all of a sudden, totally chill, and he's but he's doing that heavy, snorting at the jacket, I was like, I'm gonna give it a minute before I even hop off and grab that jacket. You know, let him, you know, relax and take it in for a minute.
Yeah, he thought that was a monster.
Yeah, he did. Oh man, stupid coat. And my own fault though, you know. Like most of it I feel like is kind of my own fault, like just not paying attention or doing something dumb, like whenever I've had like a close to a wreck on a horse, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I find, this is usually something that comes up, so I'll just bring it up. But usually people want to know about like your worst wreck or like accidents all the time. And a lot of packers don't really want to talk about it because usually it's a reflection of something that you did that was kind of stupid.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So something like that, or like I get so used to riding stock that are like really like experienced, tons of trail miles, thousands of miles every summer.
Yeah.
And then I get on like a young animal and I'll do something like that because I get complacent.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, that was stupid. This is completely my own fault that I got dumped. Like, I can't be mad at this critter.
Totally. Yeah. That's
it doesn't know. Like, in their mind, that's like, oh, that's a cougar on my back or whatever.
Yeah, 100%. So, yeah,
I feel like it usually comes back to something that I did.
Yeah, same. And I feel lucky that I have the same mindset, because it's like I've never been mad at the horse for getting launched. I'm always like, oh, God, I'm an idiot. Like,
yeah.
I'm or like, ooh, stupid stick. You know, like I get mad at the stick, not mad at the horse ever. Cause, you know, I get it. Like you said, it's just survival for them. Like you said, cougar. One like you too. Like, and you probably packed out for hunting camp. Like you have a horse that has never really been around a deer or an elk, and all of a sudden it's like, you're trying to put that on my back?
Oh, yeah. Especially predators like a bear. Like, yeah. Oh, I have to carry that predator. Okay, it's on my back.
Yeah, wait a minute. You know, and like you can't, like you said, you get used to it. Because like I grew up around guys who, you know, babysitter type horses who are pretty old but have done it a million times. So like you don't think about it until you get like a newer fresh horse. And you're like, oh, you are not happy about this. You know, like no matter what it is, you know, like you said, a bear is probably way worse. I never had to pack out a bear, but...
Yeah, but it's funny, though, how fast they'll come around, and then it's just like, oh, just any old cargo.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. And some of them don't care even the first time.
Yeah.
It's fun. I don't know. It's fun to work with all kinds of kinds. It's kind of like, I always laugh when I get on podcasts because most of my work in the summer is quiet. Like, my communication is not verbal at all with, like, horses and mules. So to come on and talk about it is kind of interesting. But
yeah,
how different, like, I worked with, I don't know, 20-some critters. That's how many were on the district. And the different, like, personality types and who agreed with who and who you really didn't put next to each other. I don't know. It was just kind of a cool study in animal psychology and just, I don't know, crew dynamics almost in a way, but not anymore because I worked wildland and it was interesting to see the flavors of each crew. And
yeah,
I feel like there's kind of that same thing with packing and pack strings. And you go to different outfits and they all kind of have their own flavor and the way that they operate things. And you can kind of sense that in the herd of animals that they have around. I don't know, so it's kind of hard to pinpoint, but
it is. Yeah, I thought it was kind of cool, like the experience you've had to be like around you know, a couple different outfits and packers and stuff, because like you said, everyone's got their own little tips and tricks, and once you kind of figure out like you can take or leave whatever, you know. And
¿quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Kind of build up your own, you know, like I don't know, like playbook, I guess, you know, for packing. And I don't have that much experience, so I don't really know. I got to be in the bob one time though, and I can't wait for you to check it out. It's so amazing.
It sounds cool.
Are you going this summer?
I don't know. I hope so. Yeah.
Are you gonna? Yeah, like the Chinese wall and stuff. You got like a plan?
No, just to get there.
Yeah.
In some capacity.
Just roam.
Yeah, working fire. I didn't have much time with my horses, and then working government packing. Still didn't have a ton of time for my own trips, but
I know.
Now I do. Now,
yeah.
Where do I go first? I don't know. But
oh, I know.
Sounds awesome.
Oh, it's so cool. I got to fly over the Chinese Wall and then jump into Gates Park, which is more on the east side, kind of near like Augusta Shodo area.
Okay.
And but we were getting resupplied with a packer, and he was an old boy, so I was always over there bugging him. And at first, you know, because probably the way I look, he's just like, who is this idiot coming over here? And just like, you know, I was probably asking him some dumb questions because I had never messed with any Manny's or anything before. So I was like, what are you doing here? Like, how are you weighing them? And it was just all by feel. And I was like, he's like, pick up that one. Let me know if it weighs the same as that one. I'm like, I think so. And like, he picked it up. He's like, not even close. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yep.
I was like, I need a scale. But yeah, it was great to just like kind of pick his brain. And, you know, he, like you said, he's like a lifelong packer. And it was just awesome to see. And like you said, the relationship he has with the stock and stuff, dude, is super cool. Mm-hmm. But had headquarters pass that he was going in and out of, and we hiked out of. Whew. That was a cruise. That one's way up there. In
yeah.
The mountains.
Yeah. I know. It's amazing, too, because it's just amazing how fast they can, like a good packer can get a whole string ready and going down the trail.
Yeah.
Like prior to doing this, and I wouldn't consider myself like very super proficient, you know, intermediate probably, I would say, and yeah. comfortable doing it. But like a really good, efficient packer can get going down the trail with 9 head of critters, like pack animals, faster than like a hunting camp can with 2 pack animals. It's amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah, you're totally right.
And their internal scale is like within probably 2 or 3 pounds, I'm guessing.
Yeah, totally.
It's fun to watch.
It is really fun to watch. And you probably got to experience that too on a few different levels. Like I got where like some of the folks who've been in Helitac for a long time are the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I guess like all the stuff we use in fire is pretty similar. So it's like once you figure out like what everything weighs, you kind of have a good idea. But there were some guys that, like you said, would be, you know, wrapping some up with a ton of fiber tape and just like trying to stick it in a, you know, a net to go back or, you know, for backhaul or whatever. And they would just be like, you know, weighing it all by hand. And then, you know, the helicopter usually has a scale in it, you know, so one of my friends, he like radioed up to the helicopter. He's like, hey, what's your guys' scale reading? And, it was like within 10 pounds or something crazy. And it was a pretty big backhaul sling. I was like, dang, dude, like that is really good. You know,
it is pretty impressive.
Yeah. It's like, man. But like you said, the Packers are the same way because they've been doing it for so long. And it's like not a thing for them too.
Yeah.
And that guy, I think the first time he came in, I just didn't, you know, I didn't want to bug him, you know, because I figured he seemed like he was in a rush and he was, there's, you know, this big old fire. That's why I was there. Cause you know, we jumped the airstrip there and, so he was resupplying a ton of different folks and had a lot of miles to put on. So he seemed like he was kind of a rush. He just came to like a cool Western, came for like a warm bed and a meal with us and dropped some stuff off for us and then kept cruising. But like I was up making coffee and doing a bunch of stuff. And I think he had a quick cup of coffee with me and he was out the door. And then I was like cooking breakfast and kind of hanging out. And I think I called him dispatch or something, but I had like something that lasted like, I don't know, it felt like a few minutes, maybe 20 minutes. And like I said, he was already loaded up and heading out at the trail when I popped out the door because I was going to go just like, you know, help him out and see if there's anything I could do and glean some knowledge from him.
Yeah.
Like you said, he's already working his way down the trail already.
I know.
Jeez, that was quick.
But hey, you gave him coffee, right? It sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
That's huge. That's a word to the wise. You should always have coffee around if there's a packer coming in.
Oh, good call.
This is kind of a cute story. My husband's grandpa was a lookout when he was a real young man.
Really?
Up on the Kootenai, I think, somewhere. Way north Idaho. At least, and he was, I think, 17, maybe it was his first season manning this lookout, and the packer was coming for, I think, his first resupply, and it was just pouring rain, like early spring conditions, and the packer comes up looking like a soaked cat, and Fred is his name, my husband's grandpa, gets down there to get his stuff and says, sweet, thanks, like, appreciate it, you want to come in and warm up? And the guy's like, you don't have any coffee made for me? And Fred's like, no. And he just got pissed off, threw his stuff down, and just left immediately.
Oh, no.
And Fred never forgot that. He's always got coffee on, because you never know.
Just in case.
Packer or not, he was impressioned by that moment. So, yeah, it's good you had coffee for the packer, at least.
Yeah, yeah.
He probably couldn't help him. He probably just wanted you to stay out of the way.
That's probably what it was. He's probably, like, trying to get out of there, because he knew I was, like, going to come bug him. I think I was already firing a bunch of questions at him, like, first thing in the morning, and he's, like, got one eye open, kind of, like, leave me alone.
Yeah.
I got stuff to do, dude.
Yeah, Packers tend to be salty. I think part of it's because they're physically sore, but, yeah, some of them just like to be just them and their mules. But
I was going
to
say that, too, when you were talking about being a lifelong Packer, like, if you have to do it a lot. And I think some of those guys, like him, I think he'd spent his season for the Forest Service packing, and then I think he was doing, like, the outfitter and guide stuff, too, like, helping them out a little bit. So, like, he was pretty busy and put a lot of hours in the saddle. And you kind of see it. He was a little bent, you know? Like,
yeah.
So I was going to say, like, with you, like, getting out of probably good things, so you're not, like, bent at the age of, like, you know, 30, 40.
It's, yeah, it's physically demanding, and being young and maybe kind of dumb, I probably don't do it with the always correct body mechanics. That's for sure. Some of it takes some odd body mechanics for sure. But yeah, I think to do it for a long career, like the guy that I work with on the subway, Pete is his name. He's coming up on 22 years, I think, packing. And that's, you know, long seasons, a lot of freight, a lot of construction projects with a ton of lumber,
yeah.
And just very physical. Even just saddling mules can wear a person out. So yeah, he's got plans to do it for 30 years, which I think he's got it in him. And I know there's some packers, you know, up in this pocket of Montana, like Bill Workman, there's some legends that have been doing it and plan to keep doing it.
Yeah,
but it's very, very demanding.
It is. Yeah. Have you ever seen the, It's a, I think it's PBS special, 3 miles an hour.
Yeah, Smoke Elsewhere.
Smoke Elsewhere, yeah.
I had a fangirl moment. So I was involved with the Backcountry Horsemen when I was in college and wanted to get more into packing. Part of it's because it was the pandemic and I had a lot more time. But, you know, the average age of the Backcountry Horsemen chapter where I am from is up there.
Yeah.
And they put on like short packing clinics, but a lot of them, you know, had got rid of their stock at that point. So they decided they would send me to the 9 mile class Smoke used to go and teach.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we're all standing around there. It's like day three and we're watching Robin Connell. He's the packer there now. Awesome guy.
Yeah.
He's teaching. He's putting on this class. And this old boy pulls up in a vehicle and gets out of his rig and walks up with a little folding chair and sits down. And I was like, oh my gosh, like that's Smoke Elsewhere.
Smoke.
Yeah. Yeah. But nobody in the class knew who Smoke was. But he's a legend.
He's a legend.
Smoke Elsewhere's, yeah, he's pretty cool.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
I actually got the opportunity to interview him because I know his...
I listened.
Oh, did you? Yeah, because I know his granddaughter super well. And I felt like I was kind of shortening the cord there. But yeah, like... Cause I'm the same way. I think, I don't know. I think when you're in the small circles, like we've kind of traveled in with like packing and fire and stuff, like you get to know these legends. And like part of the, like you asked me before we started, like why I started the podcast, but it was like to help share stories like Smokes and yours and all the other folks that we get to work with that are doing amazing jobs that most of the public doesn't even really know about.
Mm-hmm.
Or people in the forest, where, like you said, Smoke's sitting right there and like you're the one who's like having a fangirl moment. Like I'd have been fangirling right there with you. Like,
I know. Oh, God.
You know, especially before I met him. Even now, man. Like I talked to his other granddaughter, my friend Shannon's sister, who Shannon's the one I play hockey with, I've known for a long time. Her sister was like, came up and thanked me for doing the podcast to share some stories. Cause you know, it immortalizes it, you know?
Totally.
Like, and when you're talking on an interview, like, you share stories that you might not around the dinner table because unless you're thinking about it, you don't talk about it, or unless someone cues you on it. And it's part of your life. So it's like, I think everyone kind of feels their own life's a little boring in some aspects, even mm-hmm. if it's super exciting. And so, like, I was pulling out some stories that maybe he doesn't talk about as much. So his granddaughter was like, you know, came up and was like super thankful and really cool. And then she had stories I didn't even know about. And I was like, oh man, like I already wanted to come back for round two. I'm like, this is going to be like a 5-episode podcast because Smoke is such a legend. It's so wild though, because like you're talking like it's just like no big deal. I'm like, that is super cool though, man.
You know? Yeah, totally. I know. And yeah, he literally wrote one of the books on packing, you know, so
yeah.
It was a manual that I referenced when I was getting into it.
Very cool.
But you can only read about something like packing so much. It's probably similar to jumping. Like you have to go through the maneuvers and like actually physically go through the motions to actually retain that stuff.
Yeah, 100%.
So yeah, it was like I would read about it in Smoke's book, but
yeah.
Then to have him there at the class and do hands-on stuff, I was like, this is, I've made it.
That is super cool. Did he give you like a few tips, like mm-hmm. come help out a little
bit? Oh yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, and he's of course getting up there in years, but
yeah.
Is still very sharp and
he is
like, obviously very passionate.
Yeah, did you catch the part where I was like, how old are you? You know, you always kind of feel bad asking. I think he said he's 90, and I was like, what? You know, and he, I was like, dude, I'm serious. I wouldn't put you past, I can't remember what I said, like 60 or something.
Yeah.
He's like, get out of here, man.
Like, yeah. And you know, he hasn't had, you know, an easy, at least like physically easy life.
Yeah.
But maybe there's something to that. Like,
yeah. I'm pretty sure he was scooting around in cowboy boots. And why I say scooting is because it was like a sheet of ice at his place when I brought the Airstream up there. And I didn't really know where to park. And he ended up pulling his, I think he was cruising around in a van, just like going from point A to point B around his place there. And so he came like right to the door and made it easy. But, like, when I saw him wearing cowboy boots and, like, a sheet of ice everywhere, I'm like, geez, man. Like, I wouldn't even, like, I'm in tennies and I'm a little nervous to walk around here, man.
Yeah.
And you're just, like, skating around there and he showed me his barn and stuff. Do you ever get a chance to check his barn out?
You know, man? I haven't ever been up the Rattlesnake to see his place.
Oh, man, one of these days you got to go. It's so cool.
Yeah.
And, yeah, kind of like a museum. But did you have any packing experience before you took the class there?
Growing up with my dad.
Oh, yeah, you said that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hunting and stuff, huh?
Yes, but we didn't really use the critters year round.
Yeah.
So it was always.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
I wouldn't say it was traumatic. But it wasn't fun to go packing really into hunting camp because the critters were fat as ticks and hadn't yes. been used. So I didn't, yeah. that's part of what inspired me to learn more and be able to do it. Because I've always had an affinity for horses, but yeah. I didn't think it had to be kind of brutal every time and a wreck. So I was like, there's got to be a different way to do this. I think probably it includes a lot more reps and just like baby steps with the animals. And so got into just like the training side of things. And now I'm taking my dad out, which is really fun, and yeah. like sticking him on my mule. My dad's getting up there in years, but still very much into hunting, and it's kind of cool to be like, okay, now I'm the packer and you get to just come and enjoy and be the camp cook and whatever.
Yeah, it's not a dream, right? To be able to like help, you know, provide the same service your folks provide as kids, you know?
Yeah.
Like sometimes, like, you know, that, like I think my dad was having a hard time with it at first, and now I think he's better about it, but it's like, no man, like you did this for me, let me do it for you, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's an honor for me to be able to, like, take you on a hunt or, you know, like, whatever it might be, like, in the backcountry and do some cool stuff, you know? Like, it's, and there's, I mean, like your dad probably, like, my dad's got a ton of knowledge still, so I'm still trying to, like, pick his brain on stuff, you know? Like, because he's always got a little better way to do it, you know? And that he's got a ton of wisdom that I don't have, you know? So.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. And just, I don't know, part of it being the child of parents that go and do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It gives you kind of an affinity for it, which is probably part of why you got into what you did. But yeah, my dad was a fisheries biologist in the state of Idaho and just knows Idaho like the back of his hand.
Oh, so
and
cool.
So all these places that I've gotten to work, it's like he knows every turn in the trail and reference point, and it's really kind of fun because he's like, oh, you could need to go here next, or what do you think about that spot? Or
yeah,
so that's been pretty cool.
That's very cool. And that's like, you know, what I want to talk to you about, that was one of the main points I was going to ask you, and I'll ask you the question here in just 2 seconds, but like getting the, because I think we're outdoorsy, our generation super outdoorsy, but in a different kind of sense. Like I feel like your dad's generation, like Smoke and my dad a little bit, and like just the folks before, like my great grandpa who bought this thing, you know, back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, they were just like in it more, I feel like they were, I don't know, maybe just have a better memory, you know, of like the place they've gone. But I don't know, I feel like a lot of times, like when I'm talking to somebody, it's more like destination type. Like, have you been to like Castle Crag or, you know, like have Sioux Falls or something, you know, like these destination places where it's like they were just everywhere because, you know, they're hunting or whatever they were doing, but they were just like everywhere in the woods, like your dad and in that older generation, you know, or the generation before us, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think of my dad and like the people that you're referencing. And do you know Bill Moore? Have you had him on the podcast?
No, I haven't.
His dad was Bud Moore, who was, I believe, a district ranger in like the Lhoksaw area, but was operating out of Elk Summit. You know where Elk Summit is?
Yeah, yeah.
So Bud's son, Bill, is now, I don't know, probably 80, but like grew up at Elk Summit. And talk about knowing a place like the back of his hand and a place that's remote. Like,
yeah,
Bill has so many years of history, and he would like, you know, run trap lines, and he knew every little draw and creek and you name it. So I don't know. People like that, like you're saying.
Yeah.
They were in it. I think part of that is because like at the time there was a ranger at Elk Summit. You know, now it's very rare that people are up there. There's volunteer presence, of course, from the Forest Service, but
yeah,
there was so much more integration with the landscape, with, it seems like, the agencies that were, you know, are managing it. So
yeah,
like for there, that Bill grew up at Elk Summit.
So that's so cool.
He got to like live it.
And but was he a ranger there or just his dad, Bud?
His dad, because then Bill went in, I think, to work in the private sector, like,
oh,
I
gotcha.
Think maybe like milling or something. But now Bill is in charge of the volunteer program for, he calls it Diablo. I call it Diablo, but he always Diablo. Says Diablo Lookout, which I enjoy hearing.
I love that.
So he manages like the volunteer program there. Do you know Nate Roth? He's another kind of,
oh yeah, yeah,
legend, at least in our side of the world over there.
Yeah, he's in the book club, Idaho Fire Lookouts too.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I can see that, because I think he's kind of managing the volunteer side of things there.
Oh,
but
cool. I've been meaning to sit down with him.
He would be awesome to have on the podcast, of course. But yeah, that's a little more on my side of the past. But
yeah, man, I got a ton of stuff. Remind me, I'm gonna ask you this, well, I want to tell you this so that I don't forget, about just like remote places in Idaho. But back to Bud Moore and Elk Summit. Elk Summit is just down from like Powell, right? Don't you have
yep.
to like turn to Powell and then you can kind of go.
Yep.
That's how you get there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think it's not too far from like Hamilton as the crow flies, like through Blodgett, I think.
Correct. Yeah. So Elk Summit, this is kind of a cool tidbit, and I know this because Bill shared it with me. But we would pack Diablo Lookout down every fall.
Oh, cool.
And so we would get to spend some time with Bill there and hear his stories. But he would always tell of, you know, the movie, The Ranger, the Cook, the Hole in the Sky?
Yes.
Yeah. So, gosh, what's the name of the district ranger?
Oh, shoot. The actual actor name?
Well, I know the actor is... Sam Elliott, right? Yeah, I love Sam Elliott, but...
Yeah. Oh, in the movie, though?
So the name of the actual... Bill Bell, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Bell was the... Was he the... He's kind of the main character? I'm trying to put a deck together. But anyways, yeah. Bill, I think, was a ranger there even before Budmore.
Yes.
But he had, like, some written heritage on the wall, of... They packed the sawmill to build Elk Summit over Blodgett Pass on mules.
That's what I heard. I'm glad you said this because I only heard it once.
Yeah. No, it's so legit. Cool. You should go up to Elk Summit sometime just to check it out.
Yeah, I've wanted to do it. One of my friends, Dan Droughton, he was a hotshot for a long time. I think he's doing timber now. But he was actually like, you know, is there any way like, you know, my wife or your wife could drop us off at like Elk Summit and then do like the trail back to Hamilton, I think is what he wanted to do. I think it was Dan. But yeah, I've been wanting to get back there. I just never have.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. That's a neat part of the state and the Bitterroots, obviously.
Is there anything left of the mill that got packed in?
I don't know if there is. I bet Bill would know a lot of history on that. Yeah, Bill's dad. Have you read the Locksaw story?
No.
Okay. Bill's dad, Bud, wrote the Locksaw story, and it's a really extensive history of that neck of the woods, and some of that history I think is included.
That is so cool. Yeah, man. I'm glad you know, because yeah, I heard it one time and I was like, really? And I like looked at a map and I was like, yeah, it would make sense. I mean, Hamilton was like the biggest town, you know.
Yeah,
so man, that would be operation.
I think about the packing that's done now in the Forest Service, and it's very impressive. They're moving a lot of freight, but now we have aviation. Yeah. But you think about prior to aviation, mules were the lifeline for stuff like a lumber mill or you name it, like huge spools of cable or giant bridge timbers. You know, they would put a couple mules together to haul things. I don't know, I just think about like hauling a lumber mill to Elk Summit over Blodgett Pass.
Yeah,
I'm like, that puts my packing to shame.
Well, yeah, anybody nowadays I would imagine, just because what I imagine too, because I don't, because when I hear packing I think of like the modern day pack string, like you said, like it's still impressive, still awesome, but then you like hear stories of like Magruder and the Magruder Massacre, and I think he had like 60 mules or maybe more than that. I mean, he had like a ton, and I was like, I couldn't even imagine. Like, you'd look down the trail and just see that many, you know, that much stock behind you. That'd be awesome. I want to say it's more than 60, but anyways, and that's what I imagine. Like the you know, getting that mill in there was probably like, because it probably wasn't just the sawmill. It was probably a bunch of other supplies they're bringing in too, right? Like, I mean, symbols like nails and you know, probably just nails back then, not even screws, but you know, stuff like that to help piece everything together, you know.
Yeah, it's wild, really.
Yeah.
Same with, I think, about 9 Mile, like the remount depot. You probably know some of the history there, but just how extensive of a like breeding program the Forest Service had just to produce their own horses and mules, because they needed so many of them. And now it's just a small fraction. I think they winter like maybe 300 there or something, but it used to be in the thousands.
Oh, man. I didn't even think about that. That makes sense, because I was there one time when I think his name was Keith, was running the program there. Was it Keith? He was the one who was like in charge of the whole stock program there, and he was teaching the class like horsemanship or defensive horseman or whatever it was.
I don't know. It's changed a couple times. In my time, but
I want to say it was Keith, but maybe got the name wrong. But anyways, I can't remember why, but I was helping him out there one time, and we went to go feed, and like you said, 300 head or something, whatever it is now. Like, still was like pretty impressive to see. I was like, dang, I've never seen this many mules. But like, I didn't even think about it. Like you said, in the thousands, probably years ago, because every part of it, right? Like, so when I was told about the sawmill going up Blodgett to Elk Summit, and then like you said, like you put it together, you mill all that timber, and then I heard like Diablo and a bunch of other the buildings around there were built with the timber they milled. So then you got a factory to take the timber up to wherever you know needs built, whatever needs to be built or repaired, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like this huge process, you know, all surrounded by packing. It's super cool.
Totally. That and I guess I'll introduce this kind of idea, is that some of the Teamster work that's still done, like we, as the Forest Service, got to mow some of the backcountry airstrips because they encourage, you know, primitive tools, I guess. So they historically used teams of mules. It seems kind of funny, though, having a mule team out there and then having six airplanes circling overhead because they want to come camp at Moose Creek Airstrip. Isn't that wild? We're mowing with mules, but there's planes that come in. But that's how it all works with the Wilderness Act and all that. But it's cool to have a reason to need a team of mules still, because there's some limited logging that they do with teams of mules still, across the country. But it's very seldom that teams are used anymore, and people need like a six-up hitch, or nobody's really farming as much with stock. I mean, they do some, but that's another way that I think is cool. I think that sector of the Forest Service is kind of just holding on to some of the tradition and traditional skills like Teamster and packing, because there's other ways to do it for the most part now. Yeah. Not always in the wilderness, but
yeah, totally.
Yeah, that Teamster side of things was really cool to start to learn.
And yeah,
cool to hold on to, because yeah, what a unique skill set. Like Pete, this guy that I'm talking about, incredible packer, but also, you know, to have two mules or more in some instances hooked together, and all you have is just like a set of lines and you're holding so much horsepower. I don't know.
Yeah.
The Teamster side of things really amazed me too.
Yeah, super cool. So when you're mowing the...
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
The airstrip, you're not just letting them graze out there. You actually have them in a line and you're walking them across? Or?
So there, we use like a ground-driven sickle bar mower.
Oh, like an actual mower.
Hey. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so the actual gears are kind of connected to the wheels. And as the animals pull the mower, it runs this like... I think the new one that we have is like a dual sickle bar.
Oh, yeah.
Folks that are into the history of it know all the different models and they could tell us. But we bought a new mower. They're actually still making them back east. There's some Amish folks that are still doing that sort of thing.
Oh, very cool.
But yeah, they run like a sickle bar mower, which is really loud. And it takes kind of a special set of animals to run it because it's pretty stimulating to have airplanes overhead and a really loud sickle bar mower. And
I did not expect to be loud because, you know, like those old... like you mowing your lawnmower, like it's like a little cylinder. You know? I was kind of expecting like something like that kind of noise, like
yeah, exactly. You know? No, it's
not like that.
It's pretty loud. Like I wear earplugs when I'm walking behind and just making sure everything's going good. Oh, good.
So it's actually like motor that's running the cutting blades.
So it's all ground driven, but just all the gears I think make so much noise.
Oh, just all that metal kind of clanging together. Gotcha. Yeah. So there's no gas power or anything like you said.
No.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and it's, I guess, mechanized in ways, but not motorized.
Yeah.
And then pulled by two mules.
Dang.
Yeah.
There's got to be some bulletproof mules.
Yeah.
You know, pulling
yeah.
that.
Yeah, and it takes a good hand, so Pete's really pretty impressive at doing that. But yeah, another aspect of horsemanship that is used in some ways, but not like they used to be. That's kind of a dying skill, too.
Yeah, totally, because I didn't even know about it, you know, because it makes sense. I just haven't been in the wilderness too much to deal with that stuff, and that's what I was going to... talked to you about right before, you know, the Elk Summit stuff. And I guess I got one more thing about Elk Summit. So Bill Bell, the reason why I know about Elk Summit is because there's going to be a picture that was a gift to somebody in the office. I think they retired, and then it just kind of stayed in the wall. And then we were moving stuff around the office, and it was going to get thrown out, so I kept it. And it had another picture taped to this like print of a painting. As a packer, it's kind of cool. It's old school Forest Service looking like print of a painting, and stuck to it, like taped to the front of it. It's like this little, it's not a very big photo, but it's big enough photo wise, I guess. It's a guy with a gun on his hip. And I think on the back, it's written Big Bill Bell, Elk Summit Ranger from like the years he was there. It was like him on duty with the gun on his hip and stuff. And I was like, that's just a really cool photo. So like,
yes.
I kept it stuck to there, but I didn't know anything about Elk Summit. So like when I guess started caretaking that print again and put it in my own like office. I started looking up like stuff about Elk Summit, and I was like, whoa, this is super cool. And that's when someone told me about the mill and stuff. And I was like, dang. So that's how I found out about Elk Summit. Cause otherwise I didn't know about it. Cause there's not really anyone there anymore. Right.
Yeah. It's not, well, it's staffed by volunteers now. But there's some campsites up there and a small lake. And it is an access, like kind of bigger access point into the wilderness there.
Oh,
just
gotcha.
Over the, and you can get into like the upper part of Moose Creek from there. The trail's really tore up after there's a big fire in there. And then, of course, the windstorm from 2 years ago now, maybe.
Yeah, it's been super windy. We've had some big ones the last few years.
Yeah, but you used to be able to go from there all the way to Moose Creek. And that was like a pretty legendary trip with big old cedars and like an awesome pack trip. But it's pretty logged in right now, and maybe...
Dang.
I think they might need some explosives for like this washout on one of the creeks. So,
did the big cedars get burned up too?
Some did. Dang. Yeah. Yeah. It's a little different trip now. It's a little drier, more arid than it used to be. But the backcountry horseman chapter that I was in was like, that's like the best place to go. But I think it has changed quite a bit.
I know, I get sad because like it's a lot of stuff like changing more drastically right now. And it's just, I think things are going cycles. So things get, you know, like fire's always on the landscape. So it's just, if you can catch it before a fire comes through or like a long time after, like, I feel like my window's kind of closed on a few of those locations. No, that's gone, but it's just like not as pristine as it was like a couple years back, you know?
Yeah, and maybe not as extensive of a little microenvironment, but there are still some big cedars on the district that are really cool. Like Bear Creek, I've gotten into some really cool, almost like prehistoric feeling sort of cedar groves, which is awesome.
That is so awesome.
But yeah, less than they used to be in that country. It used to be kind of more known for it.
Dang. Yeah, it kind of bums me out, but you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, like
part,
you say.
Yeah, part of life. But that kind of brings me to the question that I've been dancing around for a little while was, you've probably been some of the most remote spots in the lower 48, I'd imagine, you know, like in the Selway and stuff.
Yeah, I think, I know this is funny. We have a lot to talk about, obviously. We're like bouncing around. That's all right. Yeah. We're excited. Yeah, in the Selway some, a lot of those different parts. I've also been in the Frank Church quite a bit. I famously got proposed to in maybe one of the most remote parts of the lower 48. Oh. I don't know. It's on Big Creek, like on the off the middle fork of the Salmon.
Very cool.
I don't know if it actually is the most remote proposal in the lower 48, but
yeah, I'm gonna say it is.
We like to claim it.
Because I don't know. Because I don't know any better. So I'm gonna say it is.
Yeah.
Because it makes the story cooler.
I think the ring rode in, I don't know, like 60 miles or something on a mule. So.
Oh, see how many rings have had that experience, right?
Not many. Yeah.
Oh, that's super cool.
Anyways, yeah, gotten into some really remote country. And if you're near an airstrip, then you can access that, you know. But for the most part, stock are still a pretty integral part in getting into some of those real remote places.
Totally.
Yeah.
I was just thinking if someone, like, didn't really want to get married, but they got, you know, rode back in that far, we're like, sure.
Yeah.
Just need to get back out.
Okay, fine. A for effort.
Yeah, exactly. I'm so tired. So far back in. That's the trick. You know, like I got my, some of my family and relatives kind of teased me about doing the same thing because I hiked my wife up to Medicine Point Lookout and, like, pretty quick, and she was a little preggers, but you know, when we were going in, so she was pretty worn out by the time we got to Medicine Point. So ambushed her with the ring, and she said yes, and we're still together, so it worked out.
Yeah, it did. See,
but if she had any second thoughts or reservations, I don't think they were there at that time.
Yeah, she's like, whatever it is, yes.
Yeah, exactly. I don't care. I just need to get off my feet for a minute.
That is so funny.
Yeah, it was kind of cool, and it worked out perfect. Like the sunset was going down, and I used the LED because it still has the firefinder in there. So I kind of used it to distract her real quick while I got the ring out. And so she's looking at the map and I'm like, yeah, I think Sula Peak Lookout's right there. And I kind of lined it up for her. So she's looking at it and she's kind of looking through the firefinder. And I was like, and then Ellie at the time was the only person staffing a lookout because everyone else was done for the season. And I was like, and Deer Mountains should be a little north of that. See if you can find that. And so I pulled the ring out on knee. And the sun was going down, so I started off like up, you know, trying to catch the sun with the ring, and then I'm going down. And then finally, like as the sun's about to go away, I was like, and she's awesome. Like, oh, she turned. But yeah, it worked out perfect though. Yeah, I got the sunlight and everything in there, and then you know, being a lookout tower. I'm sure there's quite a few folks who've proposed in lookout tower, but there's a reason for it. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, heck yeah. Yeah, lookouts are. That's been such a cool part of my work, and I don't know, just getting to know some of these more remote areas is the lookout side of things. Because in Helitack, we wrapped a few, but working on a district that's a lot more integrated with the backcountry at Moose Creek, it was a lot more like we knew the lookouts and we supported them. And I don't know, I feel like they're super essential in those real remote areas.
100%. Yep. And that's part of why I named it the Lookout Podcast, because you know, like I'd seen one go away like my second year in on the BRD outside of Whitehall. Now I'm blanking on the name. It's like Jack Mountain Lookout. Yeah, I think that's what it was, but I didn't know they'd go away. I'm like, what? Yeah, that'll happen, you know? Like that happens. I was like, oh no. So ever since then I was always worried about lookouts. I was like, because like you said, they're so critical, especially in those remote areas. And if you're, you know, for me, like when I was on a fire crew, whenever I had a lookout, you know, around us, like could see us and see the surrounding country, I felt so much more comfortable on a fire.
Yeah.
Just having that connection, you know, having those eyes up, high up above, you know.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, even anything that happens, you got a little better connection to the outside world if you're out there in the middle of nowhere, you know.
That's for sure. Yeah.
So like medicals or anything that happens, you know, weather stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, oh, Moose Creek. That's what I was going to ask you. I've never been to Moose Creek. Is it awesome?
Yeah, so the actual ranger station itself is amazing. I guess my first interaction there was when I worked on that ranch as a young gal, like prior to fire. That's kind of how I got into fire, but prior to fire, the managers there, their daughter would go back and volunteer and host at Moose Creek every year.
Oh, cool.
And she was married to, or is married to, the packer. So I would go back with Judy, the ranch manager, the gal, and she would go back and visit Val, and I got kind of introduced to Moose Creek and that kind of part of the Idaho backcountry and fell in love with it. Thought it was really awesome. And there's obviously the aviation component and the rafting component. The rafters go by.
Yeah.
So I was always thought it was cool and always thought Val's husband Pete's job was rad. But you know, time goes on, went through college, worked wildland fire because of some connections from that ranch.
Yeah.
And then, got done with grad school and ended up applying to work with Pete because I thought his job was so cool and I didn't want a real job quite yet.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, growing up working on that ranch, the ranch manager's three daughters all fought fire, and two of them were smoke jumpers.
Dang,
and
tough girls.
Yeah, like tough as nails and super successful. Like one is an Army doctor, dang, the other is a teacher, you know. Like,
man, built different, you know?
Yeah, and just super inspiring. So yeah, they kind of encouraged me to do it. Like, why not? You can pay for school and you could do it and it's good character building and all this. So
yeah. How helpful is that just to have someone like that's not just telling you but also doing it in their own life? They're like, hey, look, you can do whatever you want, like just go do it, you know, get after it. And you're like, yeah, why can't I, you know? It's like, and that's you know, like we're talking about this and like other things I've done in my life, it's like, yeah, why not me? Like, why can't I do that, you know? Like when you kind of realize that there's nothing stopping you but you in a lot of like scenarios, because a lot of times you're your own worst enemy where it's like, I don't know, it sounds like a lot. And then when someone's like, why not, and you're like, wait. You know, like for me, at least in my life, a lot of times I'll like pause and like, ah, wait a minute. Yeah, why can't I do that? There's no reason I can't, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You kind of set your own sailing, it seems like.
Yeah, yeah, well put. Yeah, I've always wanted to go to Moose Creek because there's so much like history there for, well, not only the Forest Service and in the wilderness, but also, you know, like smoke jumping, like you said. Like,
yep.
I heard the loft is still there, like kind of rough loft there.
Yeah, I think it was it part of the barn? Val, who's been a volunteer there for many, many years, she's very knowledgeable in Moose Creek history. I'm lacking in that department. I just
made
sure the mules were fed, but
yeah, but you got to experience it.
Yeah, and it's a pretty magical place. You should definitely get back there and bring your fishing rod. And
yeah, I've been wanting to. It seems like to me like such a hub or like the heartbeat of like the West out here and like the wilderness remote, you know, sense. Because every time I've heard about any cool adventure, a lot of it starts with. So I was back in Moose Creek, and I'm like, you know, like, and now I'm like, of course you were.
Yeah.
Because like, I, you know, all the stories start coming in, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like, the Selway has limited backcountry, like, public airstrips. You know, some of the other parts, like the Middle Fork of the Salmon, some of those other parts of the Idaho backcountry, there's more ways to access. But, like, Moose Creek is such a big airstrip, so it's pretty accessible. You know, big because they needed the capacity for those really big airplanes that they were running in and out of there, but it's accessible for backcountry pilots, and then obviously there's the rafting side of things, so it is kind of a hub, and it's one of the few like kind of access points that far in that people can fly into.
Yeah, totally. Like you said, the big airstrip, I had no idea that like DC-3s were going in and out of there until I think my last year jumping. My friend Boyd Birch showed me photos like, oh, what do you think of this? Cause, and I knew they were doing a cargo mission to Moose Creek, but I was thinking they were kicking it like they do to us when we jump a fire, just kick it out the door.
Yeah.
And he showed me this awesome photo of the DC-3. It's a tail dragger, so it sits on its butt, you know, and the wings are like splayed out. And it's at the back end of the airstrip with the mountain surrounding and stuff. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. You can land there? He's like, oh, yeah, DC-3 can do a lot of stuff, man. I was like, sure can. Like, and you know, it's got so much power, it could take off at a pretty short runway, but I don't think it needed it for that. You know, I didn't realize how big the airstrip was, you know?
Yeah. And
it's like, man, that is so cool. And I was so jealous.
Yeah, I think they would do like proficiency flights in the spring. Mm. So we would see them once in a while.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that. And that would, great spot to practice, you know?
It always made me laugh, though, because from the end of the road, how we would access to resupply the ranger station, because we brought a lot of propane and stuff for the trail crew and stuff. It's 26 miles. On a horse with a string, and we would get in there, and it'd be funny because you'd interact with a pilot, and they'd be like, "Where'd you come from?" You know, like we just flew in from Lewiston 30 minutes ago, and I would always be like, "Oh my gosh, that's crazy!"
Yeah, that was nuts. It took me all day to get here.
Yeah, it really did.
Is it about how long it would take to?
Yeah, it's depends on who you ask. I think it's almost like a fishing story. The different lengths of time people describe that it takes to get in there with stock, but realistically, like 9.5 hours.
Oh,
on a smooth trip, and that doesn't include saddling before and after, and you know,
Yeah. Did you have to pull some pretty early hours to like get to places?
Yeah. So traveling into Moose Creek, you know, you'd get up at like 3 in the summer because you're trying to beat the heat, you know.
Yeah.
The cell is pretty low elevation, which is neat because we could start working in there really early season and then go really late into like November because it's so low elevation. But when you had to make a propane run in July or August, that means you got to get up really stinking early.
Plan for that, hey.
And just hope to get there by, you know, 3:30. You're still going to endure some heat, but it won't be the worst of the worst for too long.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
Towards the tail end, probably, huh?
Mm-hmm. It's good for Packers to be morning people, I guess, is the...
It's an early day.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's something about it. I mean, before you get, like, kind of... For me, like, if I had to get up super early to do something like, you know, a fire sign or whatever it might be, like, I feel really, like, good in the morning, you know, like especially probably like, first thing, if it was me, first thing in the saddle on the trail going down, probably for the first hour, I'd still be buzzing, like, yeah... Out here really getting after it, you know, this is cool. And then eventually, like, when the energy kind of wears down, if I don't have, like, a second cup of coffee, then I'm like, ooh, you know. Get that tired kind of hits you, and I'm like, oh, God, I'm dragging.
Yep, that's what part of why I got off and walked, and then I would eat, like, high chews or whatever it took, splash water on my face.
Yeah.
Or, like, once in a while, you'll see a rafter, and they'll hoot and holler, and that wakes you up for, I don't know, 5 minutes, and then it's back to the 105-degree weather. And,
oh, yeah. Just the mosey and pace.
Yeah, but hey, you have the best office that you could ask for.
Oh, it is the best, yeah. I can't imagine too many better jobs. Like I said, it's kind of tough on you, and it's hard to do long-term and, you know, seasonal mostly. So it's like, you know, it's hard to do for a career, especially raising a family and trying to do all the things like buy a house and stuff and do the adulting things.
Yeah.
Yeah, such a, man, you get to see some of the best, you know, I don't know, best part of the planet, I guess, you know?
Yeah, and wildlife, like, I don't know. It was just cool to get to work with the landscape, it felt like, that much.
Yeah, totally. I got a couple more questions, but I don't know how long I can keep you, because...
As long as you want, I'll talk about this genre, but... Oh,
yeah. I don't want to keep you too late.
You either.
Because there's two questions I had, and one for sure was, like you said, the high chews and stuff in your pack. Is there anything, like, specific you recommend if you're going to go on, like, a long trip? Like, I guess for me... I try to do like some kind of protein, like usually it's like some kind of like jerky or beef stick type thing, and then like some salty snack, something with some caffeine in it. Like when I was jumping, I usually have like a pocket full of like either those little goos or like the little shot block things. I think they're called like cliff blocks or something, you know, like something it's a little sweet with some caffeine, electrolyte mix typically. Is that kind of like, do you have like a kit, I guess, that you kind of bring with you?
Yeah, and I'm always... For me, you know, you never know when you're going to come across a bunch of down logs with like a crosscut saw.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like there's kind of a physical element. You have to kind of self-rescue. And for me, that means I have to be able to fuel myself should that ever come about, you know, or have adequate fuel to be like cognitively on it, because there's a lot of situational awareness involved. So, yeah, just having enough fuel to, you know, get through the day, and then above and beyond that, have some as like a little bit of safety. Safety net, pad my lunch a little extra just in case I had too many trees to cut. But I kind of think about it as, I guess, like 4 different categories. Protein for sure, because most folks, especially if you're kind of traveling or eating on the go, it can be really hard to get enough protein in. With that, you know, jerky, like you're talking about, cans of tuna, whatever
tuna.
Be. Yeah. Lunch meat, depends on if you have cooler storage, but I would do a lot of stuff like that. Protein powders. I would add protein powder to my oatmeal.
Oh, yeah, good call.
Just trying to, like, fortify whatever I had with extra sources of protein just to stay full.
Yeah.
And then, like, steady sources of energy available, whether that be, like, some sort of energy bar that I had made up that didn't melt.
Oh, yeah.
There were certain times of I stopped calling them, like, hot days, because there were some smoking hot days. But I would just call them chocolate melters, because it's just, for some reason, it's psychologically, I was like, it's not hot, it's just melting chocolate.
It's melting my chocolate. Yeah.
But things that would like do well in the heat and hold up, so like high chews or whatever, different sources of carbs in case you did like come across a couple trees and had a lot of physical work to do. Having things like that. With that, you know, like enough fiber to sustain. Most Americans don't get enough fiber. As long as you don't have any other conditions going on that kind of limit you, trying to get like... 25-30 grams of fiber a day for most folks.
Yeah.
So with that, you know, having some whole grains in there, also fruits and veggies, getting adequate like color in your diet. I always give that as a kind of bit of advice to people. With that comes fiber usually, but yeah, trying to get some good color in your diet with a couple different types of fruits and vegetables every day. So I'd always kind of emphasize fresh foods however I could.
Oh yeah.
Part of the perk of having pack stock compared to some like trail crews who are a lot more reliant on
well, they can fit in their
dried stuff. Yeah, like yeah. Freeze-dried stuff.
Yeah.
And there's some freeze-dried fruit and veggies that, you know, go well in a pack. But yeah, including lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, lots of color. And then, like you brought up, electrolytes. And maybe that's with caffeine, maybe that's not. Maybe it's just like pretzels. Maybe you're trying to get it through food or pickles on your sandwich, whatever it may be. But just trying to replenish because, you know, like you've worked physical jobs in the heat of summer, you lose a ton of electrolytes. And that's how your muscles are contracting. That's how you're functioning. That's how you're offloading heat through sweat. So it's really important to replenish that. Rightfully so, like excessive amounts of sodium, if you're not an active individual, can be harmful. But for the active population, I'm trying to break through that fear of salt.
Yeah, I know, because there's that, especially being like, you know, growing up in the 90s and early 2000s, there's that fear, you know, it's like you're going to have a heart attack if you have too much salt. And
yeah.
Now that I've gotten older and realized that salt isn't the enemy, like I'm putting salt on a lot more stuff and I feel like better, you know, because like for me going into it and just wasn't really thinking because I never had this issue before, but I was on the saw team on one of our fire crews and we're clearing a dozer line that was like indirect, so like close to the fire. So you're already kind of like trying to get your mind right because it was 110 degrees and in I think it's Hondo, New Mexico. And we saw it all that first day and it went fine. It was kind of like a weird thing because it was kind of like exciting because I'd never worked in that kind of heat before or New Mexico. So it was like kind of like, I don't know, feeling a little bit of a high being there. I was like, this is cool. And we're doing some good work. And I was pretty young and into the fire world. And I, you know, it was one of the first times I got to run saw on a fire. So I was pretty pumped. And I mean, I was drenched that first day. Not thinking, didn't replenish anything at all. Just normal routine, went and ate, you know, camp food, you know, went to sleep, got up, hadn't been using any kind of electrolytes at all. And felt pretty good that first day, but then that second day came around and I still felt all right. I didn't feel like off or anything, but we were sawing in this one spot and I can't remember exactly why, but like I went to go turn off my saw and like hike to a different spot or something and I couldn't get my hands to let go. Cause I like locked up, like cramped up so hard.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no, I can't get this saw out of my hands. And so like, I'm trying to get it out. And I think I ended up like turning it off with like my knee, you know, I just kind of bumped the kill switch with my knee.
Yeah.
So I got to turn off and then I'm just trying to like, let go of the saw. And like, everyone's like trying to figure out what the hell I'm doing. Cause I'm like, I got it in my hands and like throwing it and I finally throw it. And then it was almost worse because the weight was keeping my wrist from really cramping up hard. So, like, as soon as I got it out of my hands, then my wrist curled in.
It
was like a little, yeah, a little, like, you know, little weak dinosaur, you know, like, on the, like laying down. I'm like, oh, no.
Just curled up.
Yeah, exactly. Like a cockroach or something. I was like, oh, God. And so, luckily, someone had, like, some like, tabs, like, some of those noon tabs or something, you know, and I had to have someone, like, put it in my water and open up my water for me, and they like, ushered me over the shade, and they're like, well, you're done for the day. And then I was like, yeah, my ego was hurt. And I was like, no, I'm like, I'm fine. Let me just finish this. And I think they made me have like a timeout for like 2 hours. I was like sitting there all mad and, you know, bummed out. And but even after that, like I, you know, I've been drinking water and electrolytes and trying to get, you know, my body back to balanced. And even then, like I picked up the saw, I was like faking like I was all right, but I was still getting like twitches, you know, like my hands trying to lock up, my forearms trying to lock up. And I was like, oh, shit. So that night I just like hammered on the electrolytes and water and knew enough to like dilute it a little bit, you know, like a little heavier on electrolytes, then a water, you know, and then go back and forth. And unfortunately, it was up a lot peeing, but it felt better the next day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's especially if I know folks that like get the salt lines around their hats. And
yeah.
That's pretty indicative that you're a really salty sweater. We all kind of have different sweat rates and different concentrations of electrolytes in the sweat that we lose. But yeah, just because, you know, the back of the package says you've met 55% of your daily value does not mean that somebody who's physically active in those tough, like, you know, it's July and oh, not to mention there's radiant heat from the fire and yeah, and the clothing that you're wearing is not breathable. So it's just like a recipe for, yeah. needing a lot of support nutritionally, really.
Yeah, totally. Because, yeah, like you said, the jumpsuit especially does not breathe at all. You know, it's like you'd like this heat radiating up, you know, from like your chest because it's the only like spots can escape. And then, but like you said, even if like running saw, like you got your PPE on, gloves, helmet, and all the stuff, you know, so like it, like heat's not really escaping too many spots. And I was always kind of jealous of the real salty sweaters because, like, even with all the electrolytes, I still wasn't building the salt. Like, some of the guys would have, like, salt on their yellow. And yeah. I was like, holy cow.
They'd, like, stand up on their own.
Yeah. I was like, yeah. I don't have that kind of ability, you know? Like, I need more or something.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. And that's some of the work. Like, I know we were talking about Brent Ruby's Airstream trailer. Yeah. We did some, like, electrolyte research and hydration studies and then some nutrition-based stuff, too. And for the most part, you know, they're finding that folks, when they're able to self-select, like go to a pretty abundant catered fire camp, that they can get, for the most part, what they need with the catered meals. But I'm never going to tell somebody, like, you don't need that electrolyte drink, man, because it's not justified. Like, absolutely. If you have a craving for something salty, there's probably a reason. Like, we should follow our intuition a little bit in that department. You don't want to make it so concentrated that, you know, it's causing water to rush into your stomach and causing like other problems on the back end. But if you feel the need to salt your food or, you know, something like that, that's probably your body telling you need some more electrolytes.
Yeah,
regardless of the research.
Totally. Yeah. Like you're really in tune with it and probably have been for a while. And like trips like that made me a little more in tune to it. And I used to, you know, people kind of complain about some of the sugar you get in your lunch. And I was like, and, you know, like you said, there's a lot of it, and, like, you know, some of the bread isn't the best and stuff, but, like, when I was working really hard, though, I appreciated the sugar, because, like, I felt like my blood glucose was tanking as well, you know, mm-hmm. with all the exertion, so, like, I always appreciate, like, said, something like a high chew or something like that, too.
Yeah, yeah. If you're a sedentary individual, or, like, if you're on a fire assignment where they don't have you doing much, it takes a lot of willpower to be like, okay, I don't need all of these extra packaged, like more refined items.
Yeah.
Now's not the time for those, but there is a time and place for those when you're, you know, under a lot of physical demand. But it takes a ton of willpower to not just eat for sport, you know.
Yeah, sporting.
But maybe that's a time to lean into like fiber and water heavy foods. And yeah, there's some different tools. But yeah, it's been interesting to be involved in the feeding side of wildland fire just through schooling and all that.
Yeah, totally. And then, like you said, being on the project with it, it was NTDP, right? You, mm-hmm. you were saying?
Yeah.
Like, that is so interesting. You probably found out a ton about, you know, just like, you know, what fueling fire folks and kind of like maybe even calorie. Did you guys do any studies on like calorie output? Like
I didn't. That had kind of been done before from Dr. Ruby's lab.
But gotcha.
Yeah, they found some, you know, the kind of caloric ranges approximately for wildland folks. And yeah, it's like anywhere from 3,500, like a smaller female maybe on like a pretty arduous day, up to like 6,200 or so for like a larger bodied individual.
Yeah.
And that's a lot to replenish, you know, day after day for multiple assignments. If you're, you know, on a really active crew, then it's going to be hard to retain your muscle mass, but also your body weight over the fire season. So it was kind of fascinating to see the numbers.
Totally. I remember hearing a number, and you could tell me if this number's wrong or not. There were some numbers that came out, like you said, about the amount of exertion, like caloric, you know, output that we were having in or amount of calories burned. And someone was saying, like, on a really getting fire, and maybe it was like a lead saw on a shot crew was like the same as like running an Ironman. Like,
mm-hmm. yep.
You know, for like a 16-hour shift worth of exertion is like similar to like a person who ran an Ironman.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate?
Yeah. And that's a lot of Brent Ruby's work has been done on Ironman athletes. So he has like data from his own labs on wildland folks and, you know, triathletes. He also has done some military work too. And wildland folks are kind of, they're being looked at more and more as an athlete, but kind of an overlooked athlete. You know, you're always told like, yeah, it's hard, it's a physical job, but you weren't really taught how to like support yourself as far as the human element goes in the job. Because yeah, we, you know, refurb our saws and we do that at the end of every day, and there's classes on, you know, how to maintain a portable pump, but we don't really talk about the human element as much.
No, and that's a good point. That actually laterals to the other question I had for you before I was gonna let you go, is the work you've been doing with the Handle Rugged Athlete on Instagram, which I think folks who listen to this podcast probably are pretty familiar with him and some of his great work and treating it, like you said, more like training for a sport versus like, you know, people a lot of times are like, I go out and threw my pack on a couple times, I can pass the pack test and we're good, you know?
That's Austin Womack. He's out of California now, but he's putting up kind of like a physical training and preparation program But with that, supporting people nutritionally in kind of the preseason phase right now, but we'll transition into kind of during fire season and support people on the coaching side of things. But also, you know, he's helping crews develop PT plans. And with that, I've done this before for crews, but getting involved in like what sort of food you're purchasing for crews and sort of different things to think about when it comes to packing, like, you know, your lying gear, like your, you know, 72 hour bag or whatever it may be, or different things to supplement on like a large incident where you are going to get most of what you need, but maybe you could fill in the gaps. So, yeah, just staying involved with that through kind of some of Austin's work, coaching people one-on-one, but also, yeah, showing up to different bases or zooming in and just helping support people on the nutrition side of things. Or like I've done some work on the Payette, like showing up to different orientations or you name it. If it involves me coming to show up and talk about nutrition and hand out snacks, then I'm there.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's great. Like you said, it's definitely neat because there's holes in it, right? Like they're, you know, we're trying their best to try to plug those holes, but you only have so many things you can carry with you or whatever it might be, you know? So like having a little bit of knowledge of how, like little tips and tricks to, you know, at least lessen the gap a little bit. Cause another question I have for you is, so like being, you know, that I have Crohn's and, you know, it's autoimmune disorder and a lot of it's like gut health. And so I'm always trying to like get my diet right and get enough like probiotics, prebiotics and all the things to build up a good gut biome so that I don't have to be on medication anymore. You know, it's been my goal and I achieved it for a little while. And then, you know, after like a couple of years, the Crohn's came back hard and I had to get back on medication. And so I'm back to, you know, the journey, the bottom of the, you know, journey again, not quite the bottom. I'm working my way back up, but I kind of wonder, for gut health in like anything, but especially in wildland fire where it's like, it's not all the time, but you like have to eat a couple of MREs here and there, and then you got freeze dries and all these things that are kind of hard to digest. I wonder if it's like having an impact on the gut biome over time. I'm kind of wondering, you know.
Yeah, no,
death by a thousand cuts is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I'm sure that it is, and I think a lot of that is because of the fiber component. You know, most folks aren't getting consistent amounts, and it's hard to do. Like MREs are a terrible source of fiber, which is not really what they're intended for. You know, and fiber can come in and kind of negatively affect performance when we think about it, because it slows down digestion, and you know, it kind of prevents you from getting like the glucose in the food, you know, quickly, which is what we want for performance. So I would just think about being opportunistic when it comes to fueling, and thinking about nutrition for like long-term health. Like we know that promoting the gut biome is good, you know, for downstream effects. In the present moment, it might not seem important to eat your vegetables, but we know that like long-term downstream, it can be really impactful. Like fiber is inversely correlated with all-cause mortality, meaning that the more fiber that you eat, the less likely you are to pass from any, you know,
premature like, kind of illness,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Any sort of illness, any of the big four, you know, killers in the U.S. So I would say that getting good fiber in when you can, getting a good meal, especially on your days off, it's enticing to, you know, just chill or maybe not go to the store because you don't want to purchase food because you're worried it's going to go bad or you're about to go on another assignment.
Yeah, that happens a lot, right?
Yeah, but just taking care of yourself when you can, when you have the choice in your meals and your meal components. And if it's helpful to you, you know, do track your macros for a while. Learn, like do kind of an audit of your diet right now and look at, you know, based on what we talked about a little bit earlier, some of those different elements of what we know good nutrition to be, like, could I get more protein in my diet? Should I be getting a little bit more fiber? And the off season, like right now, it's a great time to do that so that when you're on a fire and it's August and you're just trying to support yourself in any way you can, you know what sort of items you should be picking up to kind of do that.
Yeah, totally. And I worked with a guy, like his name's Ty Humphrey, a jumper out of Alaska. And he had a little notepad. And, you know, most people in the agency, especially like fire folks, I feel like have like a little right in the rain or something for notes, you know, and like, especially if you're like Helitech or something, you do like low calcs and whatever else you might be doing, with that little notebook. It's not low. Yeah. Maybe some low calcs. I don't know what I've been out of fire quite a bit now, especially like, you know, like primary stuff. So, but I always had one, had notes and whatever else I was doing with it. But, he was constantly in it. So finally, like one day I was like asking him, cause I fought fire with him quite a bit one summer, like in Alaska and then down here in the lower 48, I was like, Ty, what are you always doing, man? And he's like, I'm just constantly, like, if something hits me, like, you know, it would be great for this scenario, this. So he's like, I'm always, like, expanding my kit or, like, trying to change it because, like, you know, what you pack on fire down here is different than what you have on fire up there. Like, you don't even have to have a shelter up there, so you got a little more space to, you know, pack some food away or whatever it might be. And so he's always, like, improving his PG bag when he goes on fire, and he's always taking notes. So he remembers, he's like, if I don't take notes, then I'll have this idea of what I'd like to have, you know, to help, you know, with this scenario, and I'll forget about it. And then the next time I'm in the scenario, I'm like, damn, I should have, you know, brought whatever that might be, you know, like, headlamp is a, you know, simple example. Everyone has a headlamp. It's only I can think of right now, or, you know, like a little tarp or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, that'd be great. And then, you know, I ran into some folks that were building their own freeze dryers. So that's probably a pretty good deal. Like, if you want to get something a little healthier, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And if crews have any sort of budget for it, purchase a freeze dryer for the crew. I don't have folks bring in their leftovers and freeze dry them. I mean, that's, or just buy a pretty cheap dehydrator. There's a group I work with called Valley to Peak Nutrition, and we have a DIY dehydrate guide that's available for like $10. Purchasing a dehydrator and just, you know, making your own chili or whatever, it's so much cheaper. Those Mountain House meals are, I don't know, probably up to like $15 a pop now.
Yeah, and they got a bunch of stuff in them.
Yeah, yeah, they do, and they're kind of poor in protein, really. I mean, and as far as overall calories go, bang for buck, it's not that great of a value, but they have the equipment to freeze dry, and it's convenient. And I get why people purchase them, but, you know, or knowing somebody that has a freeze dryer, I mean, there's some good ways to put in some solid prep so that, yeah, it's available, because it might not always be provided, or you might get on a fire that has a caterer that's meeting contract specs, but very disappointing meals. And, you know, you got to make sure you're getting enough and getting what you need, or it's going to be tough to make it through like these longer and kind of more draining fire seasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And like for me, even my Crohn's was like at bay, kind of like camp coffee would usually like cause me all kinds of issues. So I started, you know, bringing my own coffee, and that's kind of like what led me to bringing a lot more snacks, like even like tuna and stuff, you know, like, and kind of filling my, so a lot of times my PG bag was a little heavier because I'd have something, you know, enough food for like 48 hours, especially jumping, just in case, you know, we didn't, like the cargo couldn't come or whatever might happen, or, you know, if whatever food box I had didn't have much of what I could eat, you know, or if just, you know, I was going through a bit of a flare, a Crohn's flare, then I had stuff that was a little more mild, you know, that I could pick from in my own bag. But start with coffee, because like sometimes the camp coffee, I think it's gotten better, but it'd be, whew, you know, I don't know if it was just like really strong or what the deal was, you know.
I know. So.
Couldn't do it. But then I was thinking too about, like you said earlier, with the chocolate melting days, like building your own, probably like I was thinking like oats and honey and chocolate, like building your own kind of bar, or like some kind of like you know, like a little bowl or something, you know, probably would work out all right, huh?
Yeah I always I should share this picture. I would always have like a Ziploc bag of like oats and coconut and chocolate, and then you could put hot water in it, you could put cold water in it, you could like put some coconut oil and kind of mix it up and make like bars kind of on the go. There's just a lot of ways, but being prepared is kind of the key there, or like kind of anticipating the fact that I'm probably going to be in a situation where I don't have access to everything, especially in these remote towns where a lot of these fires are happening.
Yeah,
you might go to the convenience store, but there's not a ton of options, so
no,
you might have to have a little bit of a what I call like a squirrel stash, or
Yeah,
fill it with stuff you know is going to sound good.
Absolutely. And that's a good point, especially like some of the convenient like staples for whatever convenience store staples, you know, like isn't a lot, like the most nutrition, especially with my sensitive system. And I never thought about that though, like coconut oil, like getting potassium from the coconut oil and good fats, you know, from the oil, like that's a really good move.
Yeah. I'm always trying to think of ways, because it is challenging, but it's really important to have what you need and... yeah, support yourself, because I don't know. And in those instances where like you're spiked out, it can mean your safety, it can mean your alertness, it can mean all these different things.
Yeah, totally. So. Yeah, like, and like you've experienced it, and I probably see anyone who's involved in any of the, you know, backcountry stuff, especially wildland fire, but packing wildland fire, I mean, really anything, because like in the summer, it's so easy to extend yourself. Like if you're, you know, just hiking across the Bob Marshall, it's, you know, I can't remember how many miles across, but it's pretty far. It's not something you want to do in one sitting. And, but you can, it's easy in the summer to go when we have, you know, I don't know how many hours of sun, but like sun's up, you know, before 5 a.m, doesn't go down to like after 10 o'clock at night. So you got that long day, and you can really overexert yourself pretty easy just by like, well, I mean, I still feel good, and just keep pushing, you know, until like you're tired and being able to fuel yourself and keep yourself from having a, you know, a worse episode is huge, you know?
Yeah, I find that a lot. We work with like backcountry hunters too pretty often.
Oh yeah.
And that can be a situation where folks will go out there and think like, oh, I'll just eat like I did in town. They're not thinking of the huge demands. Could be similar to some of those bigger wildland firefighting days, and they're just not getting enough for the muscle, especially to recover and like glycogen to replenish itself. And so they're just, they get all the way back there and then they're zapped and can't like go out on their hunts or whatever it may be. So you're kind of trying to set yourself up hydration and nutrition wise for the next day or the next shift or like longevity throughout the season. Because yeah, if you have a few days in a deficit, like you're miles behind and fire season's not a time to catch up. You know?
Totally.
So yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good point. Like I said, in fiber. Well, awesome. Heidi, thanks. Yeah. Thanks so much for doing this. I could keep you all night, but you know, I know you got to get home and stuff.
No, it's been fun. Yeah. Appreciate it. It's great to finally meet you.
Yeah. Great to finally meet you too. Yeah. I've been like following along with some stuff, and that's how I knew about, you know, you and Austin, right? Rogue Athlete stuff. Like, there was a reel that either he posted, with you giving a talk at one of the, classes you guys were doing.
Yeah. Cal Fire. That was really cool.
Oh, very cool. I didn't know you were doing stuff with Cal Fire. That's awesome.
Yeah. I got my fingers in all sorts of pies, but
yeah,
as long as it's, yeah, like I said, nutrition and wildland related, I'll be there.
Yeah, totally. And I can't remember if we're recording when you said this, but you said something about, you know, the exertion, like of like doing so much, you put it in a really good way. But like tackle all these things in your day and you're not hitting like red line yet, you know? Like,
oh yeah. 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 I haven't reached critical mass or yeah.
Yeah. Something like that.
I always have a few different ways of saying that, but yeah. I don't know. It's kind of exhausting, but invigorating. So
yeah,
I'll keep doing it.
Well, yeah, I think it's motivating. I mean, cause I think a lot of us, I think in the outdoor circles are always trying to get the most out of life. Like I think it's because it's a lot of it is seasonal stuff, whether it's like you're hunting, packing, wildland fire, whatever it might be. Like, and I mean, just like if you're an outdoorsman and you're trying to just enjoy the outdoors, you only have a really good window of like, well, when it's safe and able to do it, you know, like, I mean, hiking across the Bob in the winter, you can do it, but it's a lot more rough, you know, like,
yeah.
It's a heck of an adventure, and I mean, now I kind of want to do it now that I put it out there in the air. So someday, you know, but yeah, I mean, shoot, you probably don't even really want to bring stock if it's like in the middle of the winter, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely some things do kind of quiet down in the winter.
Yeah. So like, for sure. I think we're always trying to like, you know, capture the moment, I guess, as it were, and, yeah, you know, try to get the most out of every season. So, and you know, kind of, I think, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Kind of like the ripple effect goes into life, right? Like, cause like, we're trying to get the most out of every shift when you're on fire or whatever it might be. You're like, even like packing in the, Moose Creek, like you said, nine and a half hours or so. And so you get up at 3 a.m. to get to set that. And it kind of just sets a tone, I guess, kind of for getting after it in life. And I feel like that's what you're doing. It's super motivating for me to even sit here and talk to you about it. So I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And thanks for wanting to have me on. I'm always kind of humbled. I'm like, I don't know. I just like to spend time in the woods with mules, but I just, like you're saying, people don't hear about that sort of stuff. So thanks for listening. If you've made it this long in the podcast, we've been all over the place on topics. But if you've hung in there, that means we'd probably be friends.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, hopefully you're interested in that. Because, yeah, super cool. Because, like I said, not too many people know about it. And maybe the next one we can dive a little deeper. But, like I said, thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me in the Airstream.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Thanks for following along.